Well, you haven't taken a time warp to the 1980s, but you have fallen into an all-new episode of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. We'll talk about 80s music, plus the Pac-12, the NCAA tournament, and a whole bunch more.
What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner,
a.k.a. John and John.
This is going to be a very different episode of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. We're going to spice it up a little bit, try something new and fun. John Wilner is here with me. I'm John Canzano. You can read my work at johncanzano.com. You can read Wilner at pac12hotline.com. Wilner, fresh off the Portland Regional, where there was a keep Portland weird moment with the three-point line. How did that play in your world? Because I was a little close to it, like literally feet away from what was happening as that court fiasco went down.
It mostly played like, how can the NCAA, how can this happen, and how is it that nobody noticed? I watched a little bit of that game, and although I did not realize it was the three-point line, but I kept watching the flow of action, thinking there's something a little funny, but I couldn't figure out what it was. But did you found the person who figured it out? Is that right?
Yeah, I tracked him down. He's an attorney. He's a family law attorney in Portland who was up in the 300 level. And to be clear, like, I'm down on the 100 level. I'm feet away from it. Like, I was embarrassed that I didn't notice it. But, you know, after it was called to our attention, I kind of was like, I'm in a bad vantage point to see the difference. I'm too close to it. And literally, if you're a player, you would have to have been shooting on one end of the court, then go to the other end of the court, face it off and go, oh, hey, these two things are different, because when the teams warm up, they're only on one end. But this gentleman, Michael McGrath, who is an attorney in Portland, happened to be in the 300 level at Moda Center. And I'll play a little audio cut here. I had a conversation with him about what he saw. Here's what he told me.
My first thought was, well, this can't be that the 16,000th fan, 20,000th fan, I can't be the one who sees this first. But I looked at it and went over and took two pictures comparing the right side and the left side. It was pretty empty for the pregame. And I posted it on Reddit and I sent it to my wife and said, am I crazy or what? Look at this. And I just sat there for like 5 minutes figuring somebody had to have noticed. But nobody did. And then dumb luck with some fellow was sitting in front of me. And he had, like, sent a text and was waving to a buddy down there on the court side, sitting in one of the seats. And I struck up a conversation with him. I said, does that guy know anybody down there? Do you see what I see? And I explained it. And, you know, he started laughing. He said, there's no way that you saw that. And he looked at it and said, that's totally true, though. and then next thing we know, they had the saw the coaches out there with their feet, and then somebody from the Moda Center went out there with a big yellow tape measure. And we were all laughing up there, and I was by that point explaining to people what they were doing, and nobody believed it. Everyone was looking at it thinking, well, oh my gosh, how did you see that? And my question was, how did you guys not see it?
It was just one of these really weird things that everybody was kind of going, how in the world does this happen? And how in the world do the teams not notice, players not notice, officials not notice, other fans not notice? It was just really weird and kind of felt bad about it because it was otherwise a great, you know, tournament by Portland standards. And you know, everybody felt great about the event. But here is the three-point line everybody's talking about.
Well, you're right, though. It's hard to notice if you're there on the court. You have to be removed in order, I think, to get it. And the statistics, like Stanford shooting, was much worse when they were at the side of the court with the longer line. But how did it actually happen? Because I know the NCAA outsources the fabrication of their courts to a company. Do you know exactly where the mistake was made?
Yeah, it was made at the factory. It's a company called Connor Sports, and it's located in northwest Michigan in a town of 300. And so this company has been producing basketball courts for the NCAA and for other entities, pro teams, NBA teams, WNBA teams for like 100 years, okay? So this is a company that's not new to this. And they fabricate, manufacture the courts on site. They lay them out. They will stripe them. They will put all the logos on them in Michigan in the warehouse. Then they divide them up into pieces and ship them. And so they're just assembled on site. Now, the NCAA was told by Connor Sports that there is a punch hole that they punch into the hardwood that sort of gives them their starting point when they measure the 3-point lines and the apex at the top of the key. And so that punch hole was off by 9 inches on one end of the court. And so the 3-point line was 9 inches short. If you're watching on TV, it was on the left side of your television as you watched the court. And, you know, the coaches on both sides, it's unfortunate. Texas and North Carolina State were the two teams that were about to play. I was sitting there going, "Why? What are they measuring?" Lisa Peterson, who was the NCAA person on the site, had this look on her face like, you know, oh, crap, like, what can you do? You could tell by the looks on everybody's faces as they were talking that this wasn't good.
I would think that town of 300 is going to be a town of 299, right?
Somebody.
And the bigger problem, too, is that this is not the first time the NCAA has had an issue with the women's tournament that you don't find at the men's tournament, right? I mean, a few years ago, there was that huge uproar about unequal treatment. NCAA completely blew it. They did that study. They vowed there were going to be changes, and here we are. And the bigger issue is it's taken away from, you know, what's a great women's tournament. The TV ratings have been fantastic for both men and women, right? I mean, I think they're playing off each other in terms of increasing viewership. It's not a zero-sum game. It's been a terrific tournament for both sides, really. And then you get something like that from the NCAA. It's just, you know, you just shake your head.
Yeah, and look, it may or may not have happened in a men's game. We don't know. But the fact that it happened at a women's regional just adds fuel to that fire that the women's tournament is not as important. And, you know, and I had people who are, you know, coaches, women's basketball coaches, Division I coaches, who reached out to me and said, "Hey, look at the things that happened. You had a referee that was set to officiate one of North Carolina State's games early on who had to recuse herself. You had the incident with the hotels in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and Utah, and UC Riverside saying that they were going to move hotels because of the racist incident in the parking lot. You have Notre Dame's super freshman with the nose ring situation. You know, does that happen in a men's game? I don't know if any of these things happen.
None of them.
Versus women. But the fact that they
happen. When was the last time we heard about something like this in a men's?
Doesn't. Okay, so we're going to do something fun with today's episode. And Wilner, you're playing along with me here, because last night as I was kind of jotting down some thoughts for this podcast, there was some music playing. I was scrolling through TikTok, and I happened upon some 1980s music on TikTok. Now, these, full disclosure, these are not my favorite songs, but these are songs that I grew up with in the 1980s that, you know, as a kid in middle school or in high school, I had an art teacher or a computer science teacher that would play music throughout the day. And so when these songs started playing last night, Wilner, I started thinking, like, gosh, I'm transported to another time. Like, you know, Duran Duran song comes on and all of a sudden I'm somewhere else. So bear with me here in that on today's episode of Canzano and Wilner the podcast, I'm going to play a little bit of DJ. And Wilner, you've agreed to play along. So before we go to, like, the first topic, which you want to talk about the Pac-12, I want to talk about the Pac-12. Let's play a song that fits kind of the mood of the Pac-12. As the conference is played now, its last college basketball game. Okay, State of the Union for the Pac-12, Wilner. Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days. That's a 1980s song.
It is Glory. Boy, certainly Glory Days is appropriate. It took me a long time to figure out the words to put her kids to bed in that song, I got to say. I think, you know, it was not a very good tournament. I think a little bit disappointing on the women's side. Certainly men's side, one team in the Sweet 16. Women's side did not get anybody in the Final Four. On the men's side, it has been a long time since the conference was really good. And, you know, I did a little bit of a look back. I published yesterday the 16 best teams on the men's side since the Arizona schools joined the conference. So we're talking about 45 years. And it was just amazing how many of the best teams and the best players were, say, you know, late 80s through the 90s, you know, and certainly we had a bunch of Final Four teams, two national champions, a ton of Player of the Year. It was, you can really see once we get into, it's kind of the Pac-12 era, 2011, 2012. And I'm not saying it's because of Colorado and Utah. There were other issues, right? And we can get into those, but there's a definite decline in the last 6, 8, 10 years. And Glory Days is certainly very appropriate in that regard.
Yeah, I think the tournament started kind of with a bang. And the men's teams all sort of advancing, doing well in the first two rounds, gave some hope and promise. And certainly Oregon State and Washington State were watching the money pile up for the NCAA tournament units and feeling good about it. But it fizzled out in Arizona, sort of hitting its head on the ceiling again. Same old Arizona ended up... Same old story. Ended up being a problem. And then on the women's side, you know, I thought it was looking promising for a while, and it looked like they were going to maybe get, you know, a couple of teams that would challenge for the Final Four, but to have none actually get there and to have Juju Watkins go out in a regional final and Oregon State go out in a regional final, and certainly... UCLA goes out in a semifinal. You know, you got to the Sweet 16, you got to the Elite Eight, but that wasn't the goal for the women's programs. They needed to have a Final Four representative, and they do not.
And now we'll see how everybody does in their new leagues. You know, it's not like Pac-12 football. And when you look at the standings, the college football standings next fall, there's going to be a Pac-12, and it's going to have two schools there. But there will be a Pac-12 with Washington State and Oregon State and their records. There's not going to be a Pac-12 standings next winter when you look at college basketball. And that is going to be weird, just weird.
Yeah, and I think Oregon State, Washington State have got to figure out a plan sooner than later. And we can go into that in another episode. But they can't live in limbo with hope as a strategy for too long. It just translates. All right, are you ready for my second song? We're going to switch topics here. And,
all right.
Here's my second song. Every single day, and every word you say, every game you play, every night you stay, I'll be watching you. So you tell me, Wilner, I'm talking about the women's tournament versus the men's tournament, or the men's tournament versus the women's tournament.
Yeah.
Every breath you take, every basket you make. Did the women's tournament steal the show, or is that to be determined, or how do you feel?
At least to this point, it has stolen the show. It could not have worked out better for them with that Iowa LSU game that set records with the viewership, because everything lined up perfectly, right? Not only with Caitlin Clark going against Reese and the defending champs, but the whole thing with Kim Mulkey and the Washington Post, 10, 12 days of buildup, all generated by Kim Mulkey. I mean, it was perfect. The NFL is the supreme marketer in American sports. And it, to me, it was as if the NFL had stepped in and scripted the whole thing for women's basketball, because it worked out perfectly. And we should say the men's game, Duke NC State Elite Eight game on Sunday, that got 12 million, right? I mean, that did a huge number, and I'm not sure anybody can name any players on Duke and NC State unless you're a diehard. So the viewership numbers are up on both sides, and I think that they are playing off each other, right? The games are on different days for the most part. And I think that it's just generally college basketball, NCAA tournament is thriving. And so, of course, the powers that be in college basketball want to change the tournament. But that's another discussion.
Yeah, I think the women's regional final with LSU in Iowa did a couple things that are reflective of major sports events. And regardless if it's a men's event or a women's event, there was the hype and there was the buildup. In a lot of ways, it felt like a Super Bowl. It felt like a NFC championship game or an Olympic race featuring Usain Bolt running, trying to break a world record. Like, there was all the buildup and all the anticipation and all the talk. And, you know, in our own household, our two daughters were like, they're out of school at 3. They're gonna go to the playground. They're going to be home by 4. They wanted to be on the sofa by 4:30 when, you know, that game started. They wanted to be in position. I just thought it was really interesting to kind of watch it through their eyes. But then the second thing it did is it delivered, Wilner. Like, it didn't fall flat. It didn't fizzle. Caitlin Clark was great. Angel Reese was great. The, you know, all the drama around Kim Mulkey, including the LA Times piece. We didn't even get into that racist, sexist stuff that was going on there. But it's like there was just, it had all the ingredients of a major sports event, and then it delivered. It wasn't a blowout. I thought it was a great game.
It was, and we will get into a little tease here, but next week's episode, we're going to get deep into women's basketball and where it goes from here. But it has been superb so far on both sides, and we'll see about the men. I'm a little worried about the men's, the Final Four, because Connecticut could just decimate Alabama and the championship opponents.
Feels that way, doesn't it?
It does feel that way. They are loaded, but it's terrific to talk about right now, the both sides.
I want to pivot, and with that, a new song for you. Let's talk about Andy Enfield leaving USC for SMU. Your 1980s music would not be complete without Van Halen and Andy.
Oh, Jump
and Jump. Did Andy Enfield? Is it the right call to jump from USC to SMU?
I say it's the right time for sure. You know, there's that old saying in college basketball: coaches stay one step ahead of the posse, and I think that's a little bit of what's going on with Enfield. Right? They didn't have a very good year. It's a little bit of grumbling, fan base, and here's a great opportunity. He's been there for, what, 10, 11 years? Great opportunity because SMU is in the ACC, and Enfield's already come out and said he would not have taken the job if SMU wasn't in the ACC. And he's an ACC guy. He grew up in, you know, Pennsylvania, went to school in Maryland. SMU's got a ton of money. They're going to be able to support NIL. They're in a huge talent pool in Dallas. I think it's a very smart move for him, but I also think it's good for USC basketball because it gives them a chance change the head coach as they're going into the Big Ten. I think they're going to end up with Eric Musselman. It's pointing that way. That would be a fantastic hire for USC and for West Coast basketball. So good. I think it's a good move for everybody.
The Boulevard Collective is SMU's collective, and when they were talking about joining the Pac-12, I talked with the Boulevard. I talked with some of their key donors. They had studied all of the NIL collectives in the Pac-12 at the time, including Oregon's and USC and everybody. And they were confident that they had the number 2 collective in the conference if they were coming in. So I think Enfield's going somewhere where he knows he's going to get that donor support. All those Bubbas who are part of that, that Boulevard collective are going to be writing checks. And I had also heard that Musselman sniffed around that job prior to Enfield getting it. And so, it appears you're probably right. I mean, Musselman goes to USC. Jen Cohen, the AD there, gets to hire her first big coach since going to USC. And that'll be her coach. And so I think it's interesting to watch that, and maybe Enfield's just had enough of the circus, in USC.
And he's going to a school that values basketball more than USC does. Now, we'll see what happens going forward with SC. I also think part of their thinking is, you got Lincoln Riley, you got Lindsey Gottlieb, who's a A-lister on the women's coaching side. You got to have a men's coach who has the stature to stand with Riley and Gottlieb, I think. I don't know that they could... they trot out somebody they've hired from the Mountain West or WCC or longtime assistant. I don't think that works when you've got Gottlieb and Riley. So we'll see if they can close the deal with Musselman, but it looks that way.
Moving on, pivoting to my next song and our next topic. She says we got a University of Arizona President Robert Robbins. He's been living on a prayer for a little while. He is moving on.
He's been living on a prayer since, what was it, November 20th or so, when they announced that, you know, $250 million accounting error, right? I mean, I'm surprised that he still is on the job, to be honest with you. And a lot of people I've spoken to in higher education thought that the Board of Regents was going to make this, you know, make a move sooner than this. He was able to oversee the hiring of a football coach, the departure of an athletic director, the hiring of an athletic director, and now he's stepping down. Now, he said he's going to serve the end of his term, which is a couple more years, but if the board gets a replacement lined up, he will depart earlier than the end of his contract term. You just can't serve. You're a university president. You cannot survive a financial crisis, the likes of which they had.
It, and, you know, you look at the, it, there's a drip, drip, drip. It's almost like a leaky faucet with the problems at Arizona. They try to blame it on the athletic director, but you know that, you know, it eventually points to the person in charge on campus, particularly somebody who's so involved in sports. And some of the presidents don't care, and it's a blessing and a curse when they do care, because sometimes they care and, you know, there's just not oversight there. So I feel like he was on borrowed time for a while. I was kind of watching that, thinking the Regents at some point in the state of Arizona, they're going to point at him and go, hey, this is your mess. And, yep, you know, why are you firing other people or blaming it on other people? But, you know,
it's not good for Arizona athletics.
No.
Because he's one of the few presidents that was passionate about athletics, that had a pretty decent understanding of how college sports work. So for Arizona athletics, I'm not sure it's a good development. And it's interesting to contrast his approach to athletics with the guy up the road, right? Michael Crow at ASU, who is famously indifferent to athletics. And you could make a case. We're seeing that play out. ASU's been looking for an athletic director for, what, 4 months now? Arizona hired one in a month, and ASU is going on about 4 months without an AD. So it's just very different approaches from two presidents in the same state, same university system. Interesting contrast.
I also, it just sort of jarred me that, you know, we've had presidents in the last 3 years in the conference. There's been some turnover, right? And we have Oregon turnover, Oregon State turned over twice with F. King Alexander and then Giothy Murthy. You've had now the turnover that's coming at Arizona. Anna Marie Casse at Washington, she's 68 years old. Most people expect that, you know, she doesn't have a lot of runway in front of her. There's probably going to be some turnover there. But it just strikes me, Wilner, that these presidents that everybody's mad at because they didn't get a deal done, they'll all cycle out and fans get left behind.
Yep. Well, Colorado, Phil DeStefano's departing. They've already got somebody lined up. I think Kirk Schultz at Washington State, Cause, Carol Folt at USC, Crow, I don't think any of them will be on the job for the first game of the new playoff, meaning in the 26th season, right? Because we've got 2 years of one type of playoff, and then it's going to change in the 26th season. I don't think any of those presidents will be around in the fall of 26, right? And Cal needs a chancellor, Stanford needs a president, UCLA needs a chancellor. It's remarkable how much change is going. I mean, they change almost as frequently as coaches these days.
Pivoting topics, DJ here. We're going to talk about Washington.
What do you got?
Washington State's basketball search, trying to find a coach to replace Kyle Smith. Stay with me.
Color me, I'll call her, darling. I know who you are.
Washington State first tries to hire Montana State coach Matt Logie. He turns them down. They have eventually now turned to David Riley, who is happy to take the job. He's coming in. What'd you make of the hire?
First of all, I didn't realize that song was from the 80s.
1980, exactly. How about that?
Okay.
Blondie.
All right. Second of all, little known fact, David Riley is Mike Riley's nephew, the former Oregon State football coach. So David Riley's father is a Stanford doctor, I believe, and David grew up in Palo Alto. But key thing for the Cougars is that he's been at Eastern Washington for, what, a decade as a head coach and assistant coach. So he knows that area. He knows Eastern. He knows Washington State. He knows Gonzaga. He's recruited the Pacific Northwest. I actually think it's probably as good a hire as they could have made.
And I think the uncertainty of next season just kills them. I mean, they know they're going to be competing in a WCC schedule for at least 1 year, maybe two, and who knows beyond that. And so that's a tough job to sell to the guy at Montana State who's got some resources and can probably hold on for another year or two and see what other jobs are out there. But you certainly can sell that to Riley at Eastern Washington and some other coaches. So I agree with you. I think it's about as good as they could have done. I was a little surprised that they so quickly moved past Jim Shaw as a possible head coach. I thought that gave him a chance maybe to retain some players, but they are six players jumped in the portal almost immediately. Kyle Smith gone. Eric Revenoe, the Oregon State assistant, is gonna join Kyle Smith on his staff at Stanford. I think Smith's gonna win at Stanford, and I think you give Riley a puncher's chance at Washington State, given that they're gonna be playing a WCC schedule.
So you look at what's happened to Washington State and Oregon State since August, right? Washington State has now lost a men's basketball coach and their athletic director. Oregon State lost Jonathan Smith. What do you think is going to happen with the women's basketball program there?
Yeah, I think flight risk for sure. And it pivots into our next topic.
Oh,
it is.
You got another one lined up.
I got another one lined up. My prerogative, Bobby Brown. Don't be cruel. The transfer portal, it kind of dovetails with what you were talking about. I am told that as of Wednesday morning at 11:53 a.m., there were 1,033 women's Division I college basketball players in the portal, many of them singing this song, John Wilner, doing what's best for themselves. But I think it kind of dovetails with what you're talking about with Washington State's coach and the potential there for flight risk, because Oregon State's seeing it. Oregon had several players get in the portal. Colorado had six players get in the portal. A lot of movement.
Ronnie James is leaving USC.
Yeah, a lot of movement.
A lot of movement. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there were 250, 300 men's players entered the portal on the first day it opened. And stupidly, because it's the NCAA, it opened the day after Selection Sunday, on that Monday. So here you got Selection Sunday, and the tournament's going to start, and everybody's going to talk about the tournament. Nope, they're talking about the portal. They got to move the portal back, I think, on both sides, men's and women's. Don't let the portal open until the conclusion of the Final Four, even if that means you got to cut it to 30 days from 45. They can't have the tournament, the sideshow with men's and women's players going in the portal during the tournament. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's a huge distraction, huge problem. The amount of money that is flying around as well. I had a Division I women's basketball coach tell me that his program offered high school players during the high school recruitment to McDonald's All-Americans. They offered them $250,000 each, and neither player took it, meaning they got a better deal somewhere else. I had another coach tell me that they believed that every one of South Carolina's players on their roster were getting six figures. There's a lot of money flying around out there. And one of the problems is I asked that coach, like, you know, those players that you offered $250,000 to, you know, what did they end up getting? They don't know. And so there's no database or there's no way to check, like, you know, did they get a better deal somewhere else or did an agent bluff them? Or so there's just a lot of, you know, hey, we offered 250 and we didn't get them.
Well, that's a big problem is that, you know, the smoke that's out there and knowing what to believe and what not to believe for women's basketball, men's basketball, and especially football, right? It is hard to know what the truth is, and it's tough for the athletes to know who's being sincere where and who to trust and what their options are. And the end result is a lot of times kids get stuck in the portal with no good options, right? They go in there thinking, oh, I've got A, B, and C, and they turn out it's X, Y, and Z. And so it's not benefiting a lot of the athletes. They got to come up with a solution.
Yeah, I think there should be transparency there. It should be that they, you know, the athletes or the schools have to enter into a database what are the players getting, because I have also talked with players who felt misled because they get into the portal, they have an agent contact them and say, "Hey, I can get you this deal." That deal never comes to fruition. And we saw a bad case of that happen with college football and a quarterback. So I think, you know, it protects the athletes as well because it, you know, it ensures that the deals are actually tangible. They're real.
Yep. It's happening to, I mean, both, all kinds of schools, right? ASU, Frankie Collins, their point guards in the portal. Stanford's got a bunch of guys in the portal, including Peja Stojakovic's son, Andres, who was a freshman. He was a, you know, five-star recruit. He's in the portal from Stanford. You've got Washington State's got a couple guys, right? I mean, it's hitting everybody. This is not just an issue for Oregon State and Washington State. They are in a tougher spot than most, but this is a problem for everybody, you know, roster composition.
Yeah. I mean, Oregon's dealing with it. Colorado's dealing with it. And certainly, you know, you have special cases like Cal and Stanford that just have, they're playing by different academic rules. And so they have their own set of issues and problems that go beyond everything else that we're talking about. All right, how'd we do with the music? Did you enjoy the 80s music? Did any of it take you anywhere special or bring up any memories?
A lot of it did. It was great. I mean, that was a great time, right? There was was it like 84, 85? I mean, it was a whole different era with big acts on tour, right? Michael Jackson, Madonna, Prince, Springsteen, all at once. Yep. On tour. It's just a different era in everything. Right? Everything has changed. The music industry has changed. Entertainment industry has changed. College sports has changed, as we have talked about many times. And probably we'll talk about a bunch more, including next week.
Appreciate everybody who subscribes to this podcast. Make sure if you aren't already subscribed that you reach out, you hit that button. We'll be back with an all-new episode next week.
Thanks, everybody.